the topic of the day is, do people want to be nudged? That's the question. Now, it's generally known that mortality and morbidity are strongly influenced by lifestyle choices, and certainly in terms of health and exercise. People can expect longer and healthier lives if their diets are low in... It's generally known people can expect longer, healthier lives if their diets are low in saturated fat, salt and sugar. They include a lot of fruit and vegetables. If they don't smoke, they don't drink more than small amounts of alcohol. In Britain, it's just been announced that this small has got smaller over from the start of 2016, I'm sorry to say. They have to take regular exercise. Of course, the fact of the matter is that many people don't follow this advice. And behavioural economists often argue that governments ought to respond to this by using nudges. Nudges towards healthy lifestyles. And the basic thought is, I'm sure you know, you construct choice environments that engage with non-rational but predictable psychological mechanisms so that people are more likely to make healthier choices, while at the same time their choice opportunities are not restricted. That's the kind of nudge program. Now, this paper, I want to make it up, try to emphasize this, that because I get into a lot of, I think, unconstructive arguments with people over this. I think you should always address one issue at a time. And this paper is about one particular issue. It's a particular justification for nudging, and that is that individuals want to make the choices they're being nudged towards. And the reason I'm interested in this is because, I mean, I'm really a welfare economist is perhaps not the right word anymore, and certainly I'm a normative economist. I'm interested in trying to develop a general form of normative economics that's compatible with the behavioural findings. I mean, the two areas of economics I come from, one is welfare economics and the other is behavioural economics, and I'm trying to get the two to fit together. So I need to, as part of, I have my own project, but as part of this, I need to understand the principles that behavioural economists use when they do normative analysis. So previously, you know, traditionally in economics, we had a model of the rational individual with well-defined preferences. Normative economics was about identifying their preferences and satisfying them. Behavioural economics is saying, yes, well, actually, there's a lot of problems about that. People don't really have very consistent preferences. So it's very, very difficult to know how to do normative economics in this situation. I'm struggling to try to find a way of doing it. Behavioural economists jump in very happily to give you lots of recommendations, but you know, how are you doing it? How where have these come from? And the most behavioural economists are very, very casual in normative arguments. And so my object is to try to pin down exactly what they're saying. This is the point of this particular paper. And one fixed point is that when behavioural economists try to justify nudge policies, one of the central claims is often people want to be nudged. So I'm wanting to ask, what does this claim mean? What does it actually mean to say people want to be nudged? Is it internally coherent? Is it consistent with evidence? And is it consistent with the policy recommendations it's supposed to justify? So it may be that there's a certain area in the world where people do want to be nudged, but we have to ask, scanning across the area in which behavioural economists are proposing nudges, is it generally plausible to think that people want to be nudged? And to stress, this paper is not concerned with other arguments for nudging. So I'm not saying, this isn't a paper saying nudging is wrong. It's not a paper saying nudging is paternalistic and we ought not to be paternalistic. It's just a paper about, do people want to be nudged? So there are lots of arguments for nudging. For example, People say, well, individuals would be better off with healthy lifestyles, whether they think it or not. Maybe they don't believe it, but still, it's good for them. That may be true. Another argument would be, very common argument, say, well, we don't need to justify nudges. They don't interfere with choice, so why worry? What are you bothered about, Sugden? You know, And another version of the what are you bothered about, Sugden, is to say, Well, public policy, governments decided it wants to encourage healthy lifestyles. Governments have been elected, public policy, and the job of the economist is not to second guess that, it's just to find out what works. That's a very common slogan in this. Find out what works. And there's no further justification needed. So if someone says, well, the government wants to achieve healthy lifestyles, you can achieve help people achieve healthy lifestyles by nudging, that's it. Well, that's an argument. I'm not in this paper, I'm not discussing that argument. I'm just saying that's a different argument. And a fourth argument would be, well, one person's poor health imposes external costs on others. That's another very common argument. I'm not concerned with those. Nor am I concerned with the arguments against nudging, such as maybe nudges are not really very effective in the long run, or nudges compromise individual autonomy. On all these issues, I've got views, and at different times I might want to talk about them, but I just say I think it's very important to take one issue at a time. So I'm going to focus here on the arguments by Sunstein and Thaler in Nudge, because these have been very influential. However, very similar arguments are used by lots of other leading behavioural economists. There's a paper which is about to come out in Journal of Economic Methodology by myself, Gerardo Infante, and Guillaume Lacouta, Preference Purification and the Irrational Agent. And in that paper, we document, to our satisfaction at least, that this particular line that Sunstein and Thaler are taking is common to most of the behavioral economists who've got involved in doing normative economics. Now, Sunstein and Thaler go out of their way to claim that their criterion for nudging is to make individuals better off as judged by themselves. Now, this is said explicitly in the opening chapter of the incidental one, when Luigino was talking about the conference when he said Martha Nussbaum and I were the sort of contestants. And this claim about Sunstein, Martha Nussbaum objected to very strongly, said this wasn't true, and that she had, I think, been his husband or wife or partner at the time. But anyway, I still think this is... I kept saying to her, well, I don't care what he thinks. All I say is, what does he say in his book? You know, it's not our job. It's not our job as it's not our job as academics to ask what do people really believe. Lots of people, maybe people believe lots of things they don't write in their books, and they may not believe lots of things they write in their books. But what we're concerned with is the public argument. So, in their opening chapter, they say that their recommendations for nudging are designed to, quote, make choosers better off as judged by themselves. And the as judged by themselves is in italics. And this appears, well, actually, it's only really a couple of times in the book it actually appears again. But I think the way it appears, it's quite interesting. You can see what it's doing. It's something that they're feeling they have to put in, this clause. So at one point they say, so long as people are not choosing perfectly, some changes in the choice architecture could make their lives go better, then in brackets, as judged by their own preferences, not those of some bureaucrat. So that every now and then they're saying, oh, well, we wanted to talk about making people's lives better. And then they're thinking, oh, the reader will think we're being paternalistic. But no, we're going to say, as judged by themselves. And this, not those of some bureaucrat, clearly is kind of, you know, I'm sure you, the reader, might be worrying that we're wanting bureaucrats to decide what's good for you. Another passage towards the end. They have this distinction between econs, which is Homo economicus, and humans, ordinary human people. And they're saying, some firms sell cigarettes, others sell products that help you quit smoking. Some firms sell fast food, others sell diet advice. If all consumers are econs, there's no reason to worry about which of these competing interests wins. But if some of the consumers are humans, who sometimes make bad choices, as judged by themselves, of course, then all of us may have an interest in which set of firms wins the battle. So again, the thought is the of course is, well, you're supposed to realise this by now, that we always mean this. Whenever we talk about what's good and bad for people, we mean as judged by themselves. And there was a particularly interesting thing I was reading recently, Thaler's book, Misbehaving, The Making of Behavioural Economics, which I think is a little bit more, there's a touch of irritation keeps coming into the Thaler book, Irritation with Irritation with Economists, Irritation with People Who Disagree with Him. But here's one of the places where this comes up. He says, when he talks about the book is about what behavioural economists, and particularly Thaler and his pals, have done, and he says, one of the things they've done is libertarian paternalism. Then he says, let me emphasise a point that critics of our book seem incapable of getting. The point is, Sunstein and Thaler, quote, this is a quote from Thaler, we have no interest in telling people what to do. We want to help them to achieve their own goals. Then he says, look what we said in the book, he said, and he points to that passage I quoted a minute ago. He says, the italics, as judged by themselves, italics, says, the italics are in the original, but perhaps we should also have used bold and a large font, given the large number of times we've been accused of thinking we know what's best for everyone. We just want to reduce what people would themselves call errors. So it's very clear from this that this plays a very big role in the argument, in the argumentative strategy of the book, and indeed in the argumentative strategy of nudging of the libertarian paternalism. It's a very important clause, and I think it's pretty obvious what it's there to do. It's there to head off the criticism that they're being paternalist. And as I say, I'm not interested in this particular talk about whether they ought to be paternalistic or not. I'm just saying, are they entitled to make this claim? What does that claim mean? Well, immediately after that clause, Sunstein and Thaler say, we're going to show that in many cases individuals make pretty bad decisions, decisions they would not have made if they had paid full attention. Incidentally, all these bolds are just me, just not them. This is just to remind you of important points. In many cases, individuals make pretty bad decisions, decisions they would not have made if they had paid full attention and possessed complete information, unlimited cognitive abilities, and complete self-control. So it seems as though the implication of that passage is that that is what their notion of welfare is, because remember they're talking about errors. So so this seems to suggest that, and then they say such decisions are inferior decisions in terms of their own welfare. So it looks as though from this, my talk here is going to say, well, actually there is an alternative interpretation. I think the most charitable interpretation of the whole argument is that the normative criterion is individuals' judgments about their own welfare, and that these are revealed in the decisions that individuals would make in the absence of error, i.e. with full attention, complete information, unlimited cognitive ability, and complete self-control. And then the normative economist's job would be to reconstruct individual, I think a useful thing of latent preferences, error-free preference. The idea is, in some sense, people do have judgments about their welfare. These are expressed in their latent preferences, they're not expressed, they exist in their latent preferences. Latent preferences are those things that they would act on were they not making errors, and not making errors is read as paying full attention, possessing complete information, unlimited cognitive ability, complete self-control. And the job of the economist is to try to reconstruct these preferences and then try to satisfy them. And then they're saying, this is what we're doing when we're nudging. We've reconstructed the individual's error-free preferences. Now, this approach, Gerardo Infante, Guillaume Lacoute and I, in our paper called Behavioural Welfare Economics. And this particular approach is what is widely used in behavioural economics. And we subject this to a methodological critique, which is, in a way, only an introduction to the topic of this paper. I'll just sketch that out very quickly. We say, well, this approach works. You see, it only works if it really is the case that people have latent preferences, and since the problem, see, I don't think the thing that's causing the problem is that people are supposedly making errors. The evidence that people are making errors is coming from lots and lots of experimental evidence, which is saying that people their choices are not consistent with neoclassical rational choice theory, and the typical evidence for this is that in different circumstances, different cues elicit different behavior, and the cues don't seem to have any connection to welfare. So one example experiment, and very, I think it's rather nice. It was done by Daniel Weed and his colleague, whose name I've forgotten. And they, what they it was a kind of field experiment on office workers in Amsterdam, I think. And what the experimenters did was they went to people and said to them, "We're going to come back in, we're going to come round again in a week's time, and we're going to offer you a free snack. Here's the menu, choose which one you want to have." And it was a 2x2 design, and there were two, basically, there were two different times of day that the experimenters came around. One was just after lunch and one was late afternoon. And there were two different times at which they said, we're going to come around next week. And in one condition they said, we're going to come around next week about 2 p.m. And another one said, we're going to come around in a week's time about, I don't know, 4:30 p.m. And what they looked at was what food items people chose. And in particular, did they choose healthy or unhealthy items? And a typical healthy item was an apple, a typical unhealthy item was a Mars bar. And what they found, I think very, very interesting, they found that people were more likely to choose the Mars bar if you asked them the question in late afternoon than immediately after lunch. And that doesn't matter, irrespective of when the food is going to actually be delivered. And so in other words, clearly a Mars bar is more attractive. It's all the cues that the Mars bar's got are going to be more active when you're hungry. And all the cues that the apple's got are more likely to be attractive when you've already had a good meal and just looking for some sort of something refreshing. So there's a very good psychological reason for all this process. On the other hand, it's in a certain sense, it's obviously irrational, because you're making a choice about when a particular, you know, what are you going to be delivered at a particular time of day. You're told the time of day. You can't really imagine that people don't know what a Mars bar and apple are. You can't imagine people don't know the fact that, you know, you've lived, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50 years. Everybody knows that they feel hungry in the afternoon and they don't feel hungry if they had a good lunch. So there's no good reason for that response. On the other hand, it's psychologically entirely predictable. So that's an example of a case where you say, well, in a certain sense, people are making, you sort of say, well, it's like tempting to say they're making errors. What we actually know is they're making choices that are inconsistent with a rational choice theory and they're influenced by psychological cues which don't seem to have any relevance to welfare. However, if you say to the person, if you say, yes, well, can we infer from that whether people really prefer apples after lunch or not? Do they really prefer apples at 4 o'clock in the afternoon or not? We don't know. That doesn't tell us anything what they really prefer. It just tells us that they have these preferences that they're subject to lots of arbitrary cues and don't seem to be connected to judgments about welfare. So the step that this behavioural welfare economics has to make is to assume that individuals do have latent preferences, and those latent preferences are rational, at least to the extent of being context independent, so there is a genuine sense of what they want, and that we can retrieve this by studying their choices and removing the errors. But in fact, our claim is, this model doesn't have any known psychological foundations. Latent preferences don't play any role in the best psychological explanations of how people choose. They're merely a relic of neoclassical economics. And there's no explanation why they should, there's no evidence they exist, there's no explanation why they should exist. And in this kind of argument, we're never given an independent criterion for identifying the errors and how to remove, at least I'm not saying we're never, because in the paper we discussed various, certainly Sunstein and Thaler don't give you any criterion. There's very little work in behavior, and how we actually identify the genuine error, how do we know what an error is, how do we kind of remove it and find the underlying preference beneath it, if indeed the thing exists at all. So the thought is, if you use that strategy, then the claim that behavioural welfare economics is using individuals' own judgments doesn't really have any content. And notice that this claim is very typical of all paternalistic arguments. Think of the really classic paternalistic argument is the parent to the child, obviously. The parent says, broccoli for lunch. You remember George Bush saying that he was, one of the good things about president of America was that I'm president of the United States and I no longer have to eat broccoli. The parent says to the child, eat up your broccoli. And the child says, no. And the parent says, well, you must eat up your broccoli. Now, the typical parental argument, if you've got a kind of liberal parent who's willing to give reasons, they'll say things like, in effect, I'm not saying exactly in these words, but the general content is, well, look, vegetables are good for you, and you would realize this if you knew as much as I know about health, and if you were able to reason as well as I can, and if you paid attention to all the things that you should be paying attention to, and if you were not vulnerable to self-control problems, you would realize this, and you would eat your vegetables. So the thought is that this kind of appeal to an ideal rational self is actually a standard move in paternalism. Now, I'm not saying we shouldn't be paternalist. What I'm saying is that since it's perfectly obvious from the reading, from the way this nudge is written, it's perfectly obvious the whole point of that clause is to separate out, to say we're not being paternalistic. It's actually quite worrying to them if it turns out that actually their argument really is paternalist. And this claim, if the as judged by themselves has no real content other than this is what's good for you, then that claim doesn't work. So that was the structure of the argument in our paper. And it occurred to me, partly because I sent a copy of this paper to Danny Kahneman, and I said, actually, well, it's a long story about this, but this argument has some connection with a paper that, I mean, Danny Kahneman, our criticism of the latent rationality, latent preferences, I got the term latent from Danny Kahneman, who'd actually written a paper way, way back saying that critics of behavioral economics are assuming latent rationality. So I said, you might be interested in this, Danny, because, you know, we're using your idea here. And he wrote back and said, no. I stand by Sunstein and Thaler. And we're trying to, well, how can we do this? Anyway, so this is an attempt to try to see if there's another reading of Sunstein and Thaler. The alternative reading would be to say, latent preferences are not a hypothetical construct. They're not what the individual would prefer if ideally rational. They're the preferences the individual actually endorses in some independently definable circumstances. So you say, actually, it's not that hypothetically, were they ideally rational, they would endorse it. Actually, they do endorse it. And if we ask the person at the right time in the right circumstances, they would actually endorse those. And also, that in some sense, even when they're not acting on them, in some certain, there's some sense in which they're still endorsing them. In other words, it's a model of acrasia, a failure of self-control. And certainly, failure of self-control keeps coming up in behavioral economics arguments, as I'll say at the end, I think excessively so. Now, this reading, the idea that what's involved is a failure of self-control, it actually would fit a lot better with the argumentative purpose of this clause. On the other hand, it wouldn't actually fit with a lot of what's being said in Nudge. Remember, the error-free decision-making is full attention, complete information, unlimited cognitive ability, complete self-control. Well, I think if you're wanting to say that the problem is that if people really do have these preferences already, then attention and self-control would be relevant. You can imagine how somebody, say, I really do prefer apples to Mars bars, and in my cooler moments I will declare this, and, occasionally I find myself eating Mars bars because I'm not paying attention to all the thoughts, or I'm lacking self-control. That would be a kind of plausible line. Whereas, on the other hand, to say, you might say, well, were you ideally informed and were you unlimitedly cognitively able, you would, of course, have been able to work out that apples were better for you. That's not an argument that's going to explain why it is you already do prefer apples. So the point about this is, however you read Sunstein and Thaler, you've got to take charity an awful long way, because you've got to pick bits of it and say, well, maybe this bit makes sense, but it's not consistent with that. So this is an attempt to kind of pursue that particular line. So let's just look at what they say when they're talking about healthy lifestyle nudges. Try to work out what they're saying. Well, here's one example. They're talking about the difference between humans and econs, and they're talking about obesity. Consider the issue of obesity. Rates of obesity in the United States are now approaching 20%. More than 60% of Americans are considered either obese or overweight. There's overwhelming evidence that obesity increases risks of heart disease and diabetes, frequently leading to premature deaths. So that's the first part. That's objective facts, well-known facts. Obesity creates health risks. Then it would be quite fantastic to suggest that everyone is choosing the right diet or a diet that's preferable to what might be produced by a few nudges. So they're saying, well, it's quite fantastic to think that people are actually consciously maximising their well, what they're saying, it's quite fantastic to suggest they're consciously maximising their welfare. That's their claim. We do not claim everyone is overweight is necessarily failing to act rationally, but we do reject the claim that all or almost all Americans are choosing their diet optimally. So we can't believe, given what they do, we can't believe this is irrational. We can't believe this is optimal. And with respect to diet, smoking and drinking, people's current choices can't reasonably be claimed to be the best means of promoting their well-being. So all of this is a kind of objective notion of saying this isn't the right way to achieve what we think is objectively their well-being. And then at the end they say, indeed, many smokers, drinkers and overeaters are willing to pay third parties to help them make better decisions. Now that's a reference to people really wanting, recognising self-control problem. But that's obviously only a tiny minority of the 60% of Americans. So notice, apart from that final sentence, the argument is making no reference to individuals' own judgments. The argument goes, this is the premise, the 60% plus of Americans who choose unhealthy lifestyles are not maximizing their welfare on any reasonable criterion of welfare. Second premise, a fully rational person would maximize some reasonable criterion of welfare. Therefore, these people must be making errors. But there's nothing there. There's nothing there that appeals to their judgments at all. The appeal is to the reasonable judgments, and then we're just inserting, well, of course, surely people would have made reasonable judgments had they not made errors. So this kind of argument doesn't fit the as judged by themselves clause at all, really. Now, the second one, which does fit it, this is a bit messy because it's a messy book. When they're talking about self-control problems, they open up with a little story. Thaler said, well, I was having a long time ago, I was having a dinner party. I put out a plate of cashew nuts, and people seem to be eating lots and lots of these nuts. And he thinks all their appetites are going to be spoiled for my beautiful dinner. So he says, he takes the nuts and moves them into the kitchen. And the reason why he's calling this a nudge is because I think the picture is, well, there's nothing to stop them going to the kitchen. He's not telling them they can't go in the kitchen. He's just taking them well out of sight and a long way away. And the guests say, oh, thank you very much for doing that, Dick. And so he said, that's his example. I think that's a good example. I think it is an example of a genuine nudge that has been chosen by the people who are being nudged. The implication that the guests want to be nudged, they're well aware of this temptation, they can't resist it, and the fact that they say thank you as soon as he takes the nuts away seems like pretty good evidence that they really do want to be nudged. Another example, he says, this is the quote, Tommy's on a diet and agrees to go out to business dinner, thinking he'll be able to limit himself to one glass of wine and no dessert. But the host orders a second bottle of wine, the waiter brings the dessert cart, and there we go. Sunstein and Thaler say, this is an example of the hot-cold empathy gap, which is George Lowenstein's word, i.e. there's cold Tom who's Tom in a cold state, is Tom before the dinner thinking about whether to go or not. There's Tom in the hot state, exposed to the cues of social, the sight of the dessert cart, the social pressure to drink and so on. And the Lowenstein's analogy, which I think is correct, is that Tom in his cold state finds it difficult to empathise with Tom in the hot state, so he can't realise how important these cues will seem when he gets to the dinner. So he thinks he can resist them, but when he gets to the... Or he thinks that they won't be... He thinks that he'll choose contrary to those cues, but in fact he doesn't. And even, I think, in this sort of case, I think it does make sense to think that maybe even Tom at the dinner is in some degree still endorsing the preferences he had at the time. He may not be, I'm not saying he must be, but it is at least plausible to think that he's thinking, well, really, I shouldn't be doing this, but I'm still doing it. So that, again, those sort of examples, I think, do fit the as judged by themselves. The question is how common and how normal, how typical are those of the nudging problem? And also, there's lots of cases in the book where they, examples of nudges that they can't possibly justify in that way. So, I think I'll better skip that one and say. They say, when they're talking about what are good situations for nudging, they say, unfortunately, some of life's most important decisions do not come with opportunities to practice. Most students choose a college only once. Outside of Hollywood, most would choose a spouse, well, not more than two or three times. Rare difficult choices are good candidates for nudging. So what they're saying here is that one of the reasons why people aren't econs, aren't rational, is because the really important decisions they're not repeated, so they don't have a chance to learn. So therefore, they're not able to they're not able to act on all the information that's relevant to the problem. And therefore, these are good candidates for nudging. Or again, they say, someone can eat a high-fat diet for years without having any warning signs of a heart attack. When feedback doesn't work, we may benefit from a nudge. Well, again, it's a psychological fact that people tend to rely on their own experience, their own evidence, rather than everyone else's. And if I've eaten a high-fat diet for many years and I haven't any heart problems that I know of, someone says, well, lots of people seem to die of heart attacks who had high-fat diets. I think, well, yes, but it doesn't really seem very real to me until I get the heart attack. So again, all these are psychologically quite plausible arguments, but then if these are cases in which people make errors because of lack of opportunities to learn the effects of alternative choices, it's hard to claim that they're conscious at the time of the nudge, their choices are errors. So the person on a high-fat diet isn't thinking as he eats his cream cake, he's not thinking, this diet is bad for my heart, according to Sunstein Taylor. He's thinking, this can't be bad for my heart because nothing's ever gone wrong with me. And they're still saying, well, you may benefit from a nudge precisely because you haven't got enough experience. So the point is that, again, this kind of reading is actually going to make a lot, it's going to have a lot of difficulty dealing with a lot of these nudges. Anyway, I think this is the key example I want to leave you, because this is my sort of thought experiment. What kind of arguments would be needed to justify nudges towards healthy diets? Now, it would be implausible to claim that this is a case in which the problem is lack of information. Well, certainly in Britain, I think this must be true across the developed world. Most people, I think almost anybody who watches the television, reads a newspaper, ever surfs the internet, whatever, they're going to know what the health experts recommend, at least the basic ones. And so things like 5 portions of fruit and vegetables a day, you're supposed to eat that. Not more than 14, this is the new rule, not more than 14 units of alcohol a week. That got, when the government announced, or rather the chief health advisors had announced that got about 15 minutes on BBC News. And obviously this was newsworthy, people were interested in it. You know, there are people going out interviewing people in pubs saying, what do you think about 14 units? Do you think this is reasonable? Is this a nanny state? Interviewing doctors, you know. So, I mean, it's not something that people don't know about. Nevertheless, it's not a thing that a lot of people don't follow. So here's my thought experiment. You probably remember, or know, Sunstein and Thale have the example of their sort of leading example is the cafeteria. And in the cafeteria, they say, people tend to choose the things that are more prominently displayed, and the question is, should the cafeteria director display the healthier items more prominently if it's known that that would make people more likely to consume the healthier items, and that's a sort of classic case of a nudge. So I'm saying, think of Jane, She's one of the customers at this cafeteria. She's currently in good health, but she's seriously overweight. Professional dietitians would more or less all agree that her long-term health prospects would be better if she ate less high-fat, high-sugar food, such as the cream cake in the cafeteria, and more fruit and vegetables, such as the fresh fruit option. She knows this, but she usually chooses the cake. And Sunshine and Thayer's recommendation is she should be nudged towards the fruit. Now, their claim is that she knows that her cake eating is an error. Remember the quote, "We just want to reduce what people would themselves call errors." So their claim is she eats the cake knowing it's an error. And if this is going to be taken seriously, this recommendation has to be compatible with whatever the recommendation to nudge her has to be compatible not with what's good for her, but with what reasons Jane herself finds adequate to explain why, despite knowing what the dietitian's advised, she usually chooses the cake. So, I'm thinking, well, and I have to say, this is a pure thought experiment. This is not very scientific in a way, but I'm just saying, imagine, suppose we want to investigate this. Suppose we want to use a questionnaire approach. And the kind of question I'm thinking of, I hope this is still in existence. I'm afraid when I was a child, I used to read lots of these, my mother's women's magazines, and one of the classic things you'd have in them was these questions that would say, are you depressive? Are you a good housewife? Does your husband love you? Each time you have a list of questions. You say, which of these answers? Well, actually, it's obvious that psychologists use this lots of times. Which of these answers comes closest to what you think? So I'm going to use this kind of questionnaire. I'm thinking it's a standard psychological mechanism, but it's a standard psychological device, but it's also something that anybody would understand because it's a sort of questionnaire that people use. So I say, we go to Jane and we say, which of the following responses best represents your reasons for choosing cake rather than fruit, contrary to the recommendations of the health experts, which we're assuming that she knows well? Well, the exercise is, and I think it's quite fun. I ask people, think of a question to put on this questionnaire which you think you'll get some responses, positive responses to. Well, the first one, you have to put on one which is the Sunshine and Thaler question, which is A. I always go into the cafeteria having resolved to choose cake, but when I see the cake at the front of the counter, I can't resist the temptation. So that will be a kind of representation of Sunshine and Thaler thing. I try not to, but I can't resist it. Now is another one. I get a lot of pleasure from eating sweet and fatty foods, and the thought of living to a great age doesn't appeal to me. Now, the first part is a highly plausible taste. This is what people do get pleasure from eating sweet and fatty foods. The second one, I think, is a plausible statement. I'm not saying it now. If you said, why would someone make it, it's evidence of psychological effects. It's a young-old empathy gap, to some extent. People don't, and a lack of feedback. People haven't had experience of being old. They find it difficult to empathize with themselves in the distant future, so therefore they're imagining that old people don't get a lot of pleasure out of life anyway, and so they think, it doesn't really matter. Why do I want to live to a great age? It's not very happy about it. In fact, as everyone here knows, the fact that the self-reported happiness yield is actually quite high. So maybe this is an irrational response, but it's an irrational response based on an empathy gap. It's not a self-control issue. Question number three. When I'm a few years older, I will adopt a healthier diet, so my current eating habits are not a problem. Now, that I think is very common. Actually, it's more common, I think, with alcohol and cigarettes. Indeed, my son is a good example of this. I'm hoping that this is proving true. But I think the thought is when you, as a young person, you think, oh, I know what I'm drinking and smoking is. If I were to persist drinking and smoking like this for many years, I would end up with liver disease and lung cancer. However, of course, I'm a young person. This is the sort of thing young people do. I'm sure when I get old, I won't. And in fact, for a lot of people, that's in fact true. Most people do. Most people who take drugs when they're young stop taking drugs to get old and so on. But on the other hand, it's another problem that's well known in Britain, that actually there's quite a lot of the big drink problem amongst the elderly middle-class wine drinkers who are not getting drunk and binge drinking, they're just sort of steadily tippling it down. But anyway, that will be another argument. And again, it would be, it's procrastination, well-known psychological effect, an empathy gap. So these are psychological biases, but they're not self-control problems. Another one, the expert advice sets unrealistic standards. Most of the people I know eat at least as much sugar and fat as I do. Well, that was actually very typical of what people were saying about the when the government reduces the alcohol recommendation from 21 units for men to 14 units for men. This is unrealistic. This, you know, okay, maybe in a certain sense this is true, but on the other hand, it's not, you can't really expect people to be drinking this, eating this. And most people, I'm not out of line with other people. Well, that is another psychological effect. It's got social proof, the heuristic of matching your behavior with other people, feeling as long as what you do is what lots of other people do, it can't be that bad. Plus also, probably self-serving bias in selecting comparators. If you say most of the people I know eat a lot, you're probably biasing your sample towards other people who eat a lot. So if you say most of the people I know drink as much as I do, well, of course, if you say, these are the people I met in the pub, these are the people I've been out to restaurants with, then that's probably true. If you're actually doing a random sample of the population, including the people who sit at home quietly watching television and drinking coffee, then it may not be. So there's self-serving bias there. Another one is, all my grandparents were thin, and they died relatively young. It's quite likely I will die young too, whatever I eat. Again, I hear this. I mean, these are things I hear. I'm sure you all hear these things. And what is it? It's overweighting of personal experience relative to base rates. Well-known bias. It's also self-serving bias in selecting comparators, probably, or possibly. I mean, I don't know. But then there's the opposite. All my grandparents were fat, but they lived to ripe old ages. It's quite like I'll live a long life too, whatever I eat. Same sort of thought again. Not a rational argument, you might think, but nevertheless, it's psychologically plausible as a thing that people would say. Expert advice is always changing. In a few years' time, experts may well be recommending high-fat, low-sugar diets. High-fat. That's very common. I mean, I remember my mother saying this when my wife and I had our children, which was about 30 years ago. The advice was. When you put your baby in its cot, you should lie it down face down, because this reduced the risk of cot deaths. And my mother said, that's ridiculous. When I was young, we always told you should always lay your baby on your back. It was much healthier. And we said, well, I'm sorry, but you know, this is what the doctors say now, mother. You know, you're out of date. You know, but anyway. And actually. They've changed their minds again, actually. Now they say, actually, that wasn't good. You should let them on the back. So it's not impossible that people... And indeed, actually, as I say here in this little note, actually, there's been a very big meta-analysis which has shown... Perhaps you're an epidemiologist, will be able to say something about this. But it appears to me an entirely respectable meta-analysis which actually shows that overweight people actually are less... overweight people... are less likely to die in a given period than people of normal weight. Obese people have a higher death risk. And actually, if you go onto the NHS, has a very good website. Actually, it's a very good website which provides you lots of. If you want information about your health in Britain, and what the doctors advise and so on, this is actually very good. And I sort of clicked on this and sort of said, well, what do you kind of like, wonder what they say about this? And they were quite open about it. They were saying, well, you know, this does seem to be. A solid study, and you know, then they go through all the reasons why, you know, the reasons why you want not take this, you know, things you might worry about. But it certainly is a serious thought. Anyway, nevertheless, so but even leaving aside the question of whether doctors might be recommending high-fat diets later, it's a very standard thought, and it's probably cognitive dissonance, adjusting your beliefs to make unwelcome facts less painful. So if you say, here's this set of respected medical officers who say you should be eating less fatty food, but actually I like fatty food, so I don't want to believe that. So I think, well, I'm sure that out there, if you look carefully, there will be some medical officers who think the opposite, or if they aren't yet, there will be soon. This is cognitive dissonance, probably, but again, it's a perfectly respectable. It's a well-known bias. And finally, this was actually my wife. I gave this list to my wife, and I said, "What do you think to this list?" And so she said, "Well, you've missed this one out." And so this she thinks is the most common one. Whatever I eat, I put on weight. So there's no point in trying to. There's no point for me in trying to eat healthier food. And what's that? Well, it's maybe cognitive dissonance, wanting to believe what would be more convenient to believe. I think it's maybe excessive readiness to see, which is another well-known bias, excessive readiness to see yourself as a special case. Rather than looking at the base rates, rather than looking at all the evidence, you think, yes, but this evidence doesn't feel right to me, I must be different. So you say, okay, well, it's most people, for most people, it seems to be true, according to the doctors, that the amount of weight, how much they weigh is related to how much they eat. But I'm special, I've got some kind of, it's clear from my experience that my metabolism is such that I can't control my weight by eating less. Alternatively, which I think actually is probably most likely, it's probably outright self-deception. People are saying, I mean, there was a television program relatively recently tracking people who were obese and watching what they're doing. And the kind of picture was that they were saying, "Well, I don't eat very much," and then they would kind of sneak out into the fridge and when they were looking. And the television cameras actually was there. But you know, so you say, "Well, of course, you know, I follow the doctor's advice, and I seem to be fat. You know, how is it?" And in fact, the answer is because they don't follow the doctor's advice, but they refuse to admit that even themselves that they're not doing it. So what's the point? The point of this thought experiment is there are loads and loads of ways in which a person can explain why she knowingly acts against well-grounded but unwelcome recommendations. And failures of self-control is only one of those. It's just one of them. And probably not the most... Well, I think there's some reason to think it's not the most likely. One of the ones is that the difference between the failure of self-control and all those other arguments is that failure of self-control includes the clause, "I'm making a mistake." And the "I'm making a mistake" is critical for the Sunstein and Thaler argument, because it's because you're admitting you're making a mistake that the "as judged by themselves" clause comes into play. On the other hand, again, appeal to psychology. Do you prefer to say, this is unfortunate, you know, "I'm eating too much, I'm making a mistake," or do you want to say, "I'm eating too much, but it's not a mistake"? Well, so again, this seems that all the other arguments are ones that are more appealing. And this is my, final page. That's the final page. So you see, the thought there is that failures of self, it seems as though, although failures of self-control is a genuine phenomenon, I don't deny that, and that people, but why is it that failures of self-control have got such a behavioural, I mean, there are all these biases are well-known to psychologists, they're well-known to behavioural economists, and yet behavioural economists are picking up on this one particular bias, self-control, and building lots of, I mean, I can't tell you more about this, but building some extraordinarily complicated and extraordinarily implausible theories around people suffering from self-control problems and trying to overcome them. Why is that? And two reasons. The first is that it's an economists enjoy it because it allows you to use very sophisticated tools of economics and game theory about multiple selves and in rational interactions between them, and you can model this particular psychological idea by creating rational choice models in which people are actually more rational than the traditional ones, the more sophisticated, more sophisticatedly rational, more complicated things to analyze. And you don't have to throw away rational choice economics and get into psychology, you just have to kind of build these ultra complicated models. So even if it's not very plausible psychologically, it's more interesting to a theorist. But the other one, which is obviously, I think, is what's going on in Sunstein and Thaler, is that if you attribute irrational behavior to failures of self-control, it allows you to justify paternalistic interventions by saying they satisfy the preferences that individuals consciously endorse, rather than saying, "Well, this is what people do." It's And it's not saying this is what people rationally choose to do as neoclassical agents. It's saying this is what people choose to do as human beings who've got ordinary human psychology. They choose to do this. They don't see anything wrong in it. You, the health expert, can see that it's leading them into problems. You, the health expert, might want to nudge them, but you can't sit back. You can't just say yes, and they really want me to do it. That's what I'm saying. So, are there good reasons? I think not. And that's it. So, thank you very much. I'm pleased to hear your comments.